What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
Coming up on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast.
It was in the last round of qualifying, so the main draw guys were just arriving. You know, I'd been there a couple of days, and I'm tying my shoelaces, and I just listen, and I hear this, ciao, bonjour, hello. I turn around, and, you know, this golden god, Roger Federer, has just strutted in with a crew of his lads and was sort of smiling and looking side to side, having just greeted everyone in three languages. As you say, to your point, he needs to be on top of everything. So, you know, nobody was going to be left out here. I was going to say hello to everybody in their native tongue, you know.
So some of you may know that I am a tennis nut. I've played tennis all my life since I was around 10 years of age. Memories of batting the ball against a wall in 1980 in Waterford against the gable end of my house, watching Bjorn Borg win Wimbledon for the fifth time in a row, being devastated when he lost to McEnroe going for his sixth in a row. I've always been fascinated by the routines, lifestyles, diet, psychology, culture, history, future of tennis. And tennis players. As I speak to you, I'm looking at a giant black and white photograph of one of my tennis heroes, Roger Federer, up on the wall, which inspires me to actually keep working. Actually, it's a beautiful shot of Federer in full flight and the beauty of and grace that he possessed in doing so. So this week, I'm delighted to be joined on this episode by one of the best tennis players Ireland has ever produced, and certainly the highest ranked tennis player Ireland has produced in the modern era. Conor Nyland played for many years at a professional level on the ATP World Tour. He was coached at the tennis academy of the legendary coach Nick Bollettieri, who also coached Sharapova and even for a period the Venus Williams and Serena Williams. And he even qualified for Wimbledon as one of the only Irish players ever to do so. And I remember watching Conor, and you'll hear more about this later, in that epic first round match he played, which was broadcast spontaneously on TG Cahir. And the winner, of course, of this match would play Roger Federer on centre court. And it was absolutely heartbreaking to watch Conor lose in five sets. But more about that later. He's also met some of the tennis greats. And on this episode, he takes me behind the scenes of his fascinating world.
Andre, can I get you anything? And he was sort of like, I got a glass of water. You know, it was like he was giving the person something to do just because they'd asked. So, but again, just this difference between me sitting there in the corner, nobody knows, you know, who any of us are. And then Andre was the star around which the tournament kind of revolved. Like, the tournament needs an Andre Agassi because he's the big name. He sells the tickets. Me though.
No, but we all know about this tennis resignation, there. This thing about getting tight, choking and everything. It happens to all tennis players. It happens sort of in golf as
well. Although the very, very top, the real champions seem to not. Like, if you look at an outside court at a Grand Slam, it's happening all over the place. But, like, the TV tend to obviously show the main courts, and it's the guys who are the front runners just getting it done every single time.
Why do they not choke?
I don't know. I do not know. You came on and we were hitting a few balls, and you hit this beautiful little backhand up the line, turned me one way and then the other. I went out to hit a sort of a slid over and rolled over on my ankle and went down like a sack of potatoes.
And I thought he was taking the piss.
As did the whole balcony in Mount Pleasant. Oh, this is a
Mario prank. Connor.
Connor has just published a fascinating book. A book called The Racket, On Tour with Tennis's Golden Generation and the Other 99%. And he tells me all about it in just a few minutes' time. But first, listen, it's the weekend. It's the weekend for the weekend that's in it. It had to be Taylor Swift's voicemails.
This is Taylor Swift's
Irish
voicemail messaging service. Please leave a message.
Hi, Taylor. This is Leo Varadkar here. I got your number from Kylie Minogue, hope you don't mind. Listen, thanks for all the words of wisdom down through the years. A couple of things. I'm actually looking for a ticket, if you might have one going spare. My usual sources weren't there. You know, I can't get arrested once you lose this job. But anyway, just another question. I loved your lyrics. They were always fantastic. The haters going to hate. Just one question. How do you actually shake it off? I haven't managed to be able to do that. Thanks.
Hello, Taylor. This is Pascal Donoghue here, Minister for Public Expenditure in the Republic of Ireland. First of all, you are very welcome to our country. Second of all, I am a self-avowed Swiftie. I particularly enjoyed Folklore and Reputation, which is, of course, a change of genres, and I respect you very much for that. I would also finally like to thank you for injecting, I have it here, 148,500,004 pennies. Into our local economy. Thank you.
Hello, Taylor. This is Michael O'Leary here of Ryanair. Listen, if your Aer Lingus flight back out of this dump is cancelled by those Aer Lingus wasters, there's a seat with your name on it, a Ryanair 737 MAX, leaving at 2 o'clock in the morning on Monday morning. Now, it won't actually drop you to where your intended destination is, which is, I think, Denver, Colorado, but it will leave you in Bratislava, and there's a couple of connecting flights you can get over the North Pole. But anyway, now, there might be a bit of a... there's a bit of a stag do going on that flight, but anyway, they mightn't be to your taste. But listen, beggars can't be choosers. Good luck.
Who are you, Taylor? Brian Caird here, former manager of the Irish Republic soccer team. Listen, I'm very acquainted with the Aviva. There's a couple of bumps there on the right-hand side of the pitch, so I'd say you steer out to the left, right? Now, you're backing singers, right? I'm telling you, the sun goes in there at around 8:35 in the middle of June, right? So you don't want to be in the shadow because your eye line will be distracted away from the public. And the left-hand side, it can get a bit shaky in the stadium as well. So watch your house, okay? Take it easy. Good luck.
Okay. If you want to get in touch with me, of course, remember, it's mariorosenstock@gmail.com. You can get in touch with your constructive comments, criticism, ideas for guests, ideas for sketches, anything you want to know. I get back to 99% of them and I do read them all. So let's get straight to centre court and meet one of Ireland's greatest ever tennis players, Conor Nyland. Just before we officially kicked off our chat, he told me that he was going to be talking about his new book on the Brendan O'Connor Show soon after. And look, you know me well by now. I just couldn't help myself. I just had to dive right in there.
Doing Brendan O'Connor on Saturday.
Well,
he's
O'Connor.
On holiday.
I can do Brendan O'Connor for you if you want. I can do him from holiday if you want. Sorry, I was on holiday. I'm over here. I've got, well, you mightn't want to see this, but I've got my top off at the moment, but I can do you poolside. How's your backhand?
That's him. Yep. That's him.
Okay, so Conor, listen, yes. Thanks a million for coming on the podcast.
Great to be here.
Full disclosure, I know you, and you're a very nice person.
Thank you very much.
And of course, not only do I know you, but I love tennis, and a lot of people who know me know I love tennis, and I've been playing since I was, you know, about 10 or so. And of course, you are you have been a fine tennis player, and Ireland's leading tennis player at one stage. And you played Wimbledon, you played the US Open, and you played Davis Cup for Ireland. And now I'm looking at your book, The Racket, by Conor Nyland, a hardback book, beautiful book. And on the front of it is a broken tennis racket. And just before we came on, I asked you, is that your tennis racket? And you said, well, there's a story to that. So tell me.
Yes. So, that is my tennis racket. Yeah. Or it was. Before
it had
been smashed to smithereens. I didn't smash it.
Oh.
So Penguin, who have been an amazing group to work with on this over the last few years, obviously came through with a number of cover options. And one of them was a broken racket. And I said, that's a great idea. I love it. But the racket you've chosen is like something you'd find, you know, under the stairs from the 1980s. It wouldn't be, say, a professional's racket. And they went, oh my God, you're right. Actually, you know, it's not quite right. So I said, listen, do you have a racket? We could maybe smash it up. So I brought the racket into the Penguin office and it was sent off to the UK. I said, lad, send me a video, whoever it is that smashes this. This is hilarious. I've gotten the publisher smashing rackets. That's how, you know, how deep this book is. So they smashed it up and took a photo, and I think it looks really cool.
Yeah. The racket. Okay, for I'm going to read this book because obviously I'm a tennis nut, and I'm going to read this book, but I haven't read it yet, and thanks for giving it to me. So sell it to me in a brief way.
So it's the story of the crazy life of the guy ranked between, say, 100 and 300 in the world. So you see on TV the very best guys in the world and their entourages and the glamour of tennis. And while there's been I guess, some long form articles, some podcasts, etc., on what that life is like for guys trying to get into that top 100 and the big tournaments. There hasn't been a long form book. There hasn't been a book on it. And we all know Andre Agassi's probably in everyone's top three sports books
and
ever.
And in some people's top three books.
Yeah. And, you know, everybody I've ever spoken to about tennis usually throws that into the conversation. So we think tennis lends itself to that sort of look, I suppose. You'd really get inside my head in this. And while it's not a book about me per se, I'm obviously the vehicle to show you the Pro Tour. So that was important, that this isn't the autobiography of Conor Nyland. This is a book about pro tennis, challenger tennis. And obviously then I also get the glimpses of the very top. So you're able to see, and I'm able to describe what it looks like in the locker room at the biggest tournaments when Roger Federer walks in when I'm about to play Novak Djokovic at the US Open. So I'm able to show the really tough side, the grimy side, but also a bit of the glamour too. So you're getting a really good feel for it.
So in a way, your modern tennis is Eamon Dunphy, who did only a game in 1974. And I was playing for Millwall, and I saw the greats, John Giles, George Best. Played with them all, but I didn't. I didn't play for Ireland.
That's it. Yeah,
you know. So
he we would have come up in early conversations with Penguin, obviously, and I read it many years ago.
Yeah, did you?
Yeah. I'm big reader, and I think that comes through in the book. And obviously Paul Kimmage's Rough Ride as well.
Yeah.
What we didn't want, and what was important here, was that we didn't want somebody getting hit over the head for 250 pages about how tough this life is, that it needed to have a humour and a lightness to it as well, which I think this has. I think we found that balance, and, you know, initial reactions, obviously, you know, Ed Caesar, who wrote a great book called The Moth on the Mountain, has come through with a brilliant recommendation and talked about the Kitchen Confidential of Tennis, that the look inside the kitchen, I suppose. So it's been an amazing experience. So coming out now, June the 6th.
Lovely.
So we're ready to go.
D-Day,
the longest day.
The longest day.
Which is actually a chapter a chapter title in the book as well, about my day at Wimbledon. So that was a coincidence, but there you go.
Yeah.
I'm getting used to making all these connections after writing the book. So
exactly, that's what happens to your brain, you see. You turn into this associative brain thing.
I wrote a lot of this, you know, 3 a.m. I'd wake up and, you know, I had my phone beside my bed and I'd put in the notes, you know, I'd write a little paragraph. I was doing that for a couple of years.
Oh, yeah, lovely.
Because somebody told me at the start.
You'd wake up at 4 a.m.
You'd be like, if you have an idea, make sure you write it down, because you think you'll remember it in the morning and you never do. And that was great. So I had all these notes that obviously then turn into paragraphs and scenes and stories, and you make these connections. So, but like, even now, I read the audiobook for it as well. So, you know, even when I'm reading, I'm like, oh, I wish I could have put in a sentence there, a scene there. I'll probably constantly be editing this book for the rest of my life. We think it's turned out really well. So
good.
Delighted.
You watched a match to do this book. You watched a match that you played yourself. Tell me about that match. Tell me about the significance of that match, and tell me why that match was so important.
So, the Wimbledon match was obviously the biggest match of my career, in the sense of, you know, it was my first time playing in a Grand Slam, and of all the Grand Slams, Wimbledon is obviously the number one. And somebody a few days after I had played in Wimbledon sent me these DVDs from the T.G. Cahir commentary of the match,
of which I was watching live.
Yes, and I put them in a drawer for about 12 years. So I pulled out these dusty DVDs and sat down with Gavin Cooney, the 42.ie, who helped me on this book, and we sat there for 4 hours and went through the match and worked up the chapter then after, and it was a really great opportunity. The book doesn't do it in any other scene, where it takes you into the mind of a player who's playing at Wimbledon through a match, and, you know, my reactions, my thought processes after winning a point, after losing a point, the ebbs and the flows over 4 hours. So I thought it was a really unique kind of insight into what goes through a player's mind at a Grand Slam. Obviously personal to me in some ways, being Irish and all that comes into it, but it was, that's one chapter, obviously towards the end of the book, but really kind of cathartic, I suppose, to watch it back. I hadn't done it in full So yeah, great to get that. Great that out there.
You lost in five sets in that match to Mannarino.
Yep.
What's his first name? Andre?
Adrian.
Adrian Mannarino, who is one of the most talented players on the tour.
Yeah, still out there.
Still out there, and subsequently emerged as one of the most talented players on the tour. Great hands, great feel.
Yep.
He doesn't seem to hit the ball very hard, but he generates a lot of pace with just pure timing.
His racket is strong like a fishing net. It mightn't mean anything to non-tennis people, but his racket is strong at about 22 pounds. You know, mine would have been done at 55 or whatever. So
I've never even heard of 22 pounds.
Yeah, I didn't even think you could string a racket at that. So he's like got a... It's a banjo, so he's just like popping it around, and it doesn't make any sound when he's hitting the ball, and it takes nothing out of him. That's why he's still out there at 30, I don't know what he is now, 37 or something.
He was a terrific player. Yeah. He's a terrific player. And you were leading two sets to love, were you? Or two sets to one?
Yeah, so I was up, the big lead was the four, I was up 4-1 double break, so 4-1 serving in the fifth. So that was the big one. I was kind of, I lost the first set, won the second, lost the third, won the fourth. But was in my hands, I suppose, at 4-1 the fifth double break to play Roger Federer on centre court. You try and avoid looking at draws and stuff ahead of you in tournaments, but in this one I couldn't miss it. So got a little bit tight, Mario, and didn't get it done. But
listen,
as somebody who's read the book said to me, for what it's worth, the fact that you lost that match makes the book a lot better, a lot more interesting. So and then. Not to move off from Wimbledon, but went to US Open then a few months later, having missed my chance to play Federer on the biggest court in the world, and qualified and drew Novak Djokovic and got to play him on...
You kept me up later that night as well.
At the Rush Stadium. yeah. And well, I didn't last too long. Match was not as long as the other one at Wimbledon. But so that was a great chance for me to obviously, I suppose, I don't know, erase some bad memories of having missed playing on a big court at Wimbledon. So got drawn against Djokovic at the US Open, but got food poisoning and had to go out there. You know,
bad food poisoning.
I was sick.
You were
drained. I was properly sick. Yeah. I was vomiting, you know, a couple of hours before the match, and then you know the day or two before, overnight, and all the rest. It wasn't pretty, and so couldn't really enjoy all that prep and stuff. But again, I think it's made for a more interesting story.
Yeah. Chapter 8, the shits.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah. That was it.
Djokovic, normally people are shitting themselves when they play Djokovic. That's but it. Not literally. Mm-hmm. Did he say anything to you when you shook hands?
Well, I think John McEnroe said in commentary the next night, he said, you know, if you qualify into US Open and draw Novak Djokovic, that's enough to make anyone sick.
Did he say anything to you when
he said he needs to work on his fitness. That's what he said. Yes.
About you?
Yeah, so basically me and... Luke Sorensen, whose dad, Sean, was the last Irish guy or Irish-born guy to play in Wimbledon in, I think, 1981. And then Luke, who was born and raised in Germany but played for Ireland, was also in the main draw of the US Open that year. And he retired in the fourth set with cramp against a Brazilian guy. And so obviously a neat little way to describe the two Irish guys is, you know, the guys need to work in their fitness. So they both, you know, 0-2 and didn't finish the match. It looked terrible. It looked like we were out in the pints for the weekend probably thought. But so John, I've never met John McEnroe and didn't see him after. But apparently he was quite excited about the fact that we got through because he still, you know, has that Irish kind of feel and whatever.
What about Djokovic? Did Djokovic say anything to...
Sorry, yes. Yeah. So he did not know. No. So I went up to the net after whatever the was a set in 5-1 and, you know, went to the umpire and showed, you know, showed that I wasn't able to continue. And he was at the back of the court sort of dabbing his brow, you know, barely broken sweat, and sort of turned and could see me at the net. You know, he's been around town long enough to know what I was doing. So walked up and shook my hand, and I said, "Listen, I'm sick. You know, I have to stop. I'm sorry." And he kind of looked, you know, faintly sort of surprised, and then just sort of, you know, tilted his head and didn't actually say, "Oh, you know," because that's what happens usually. You know, you say, "Oh, that's tough. So sorry. You know, hope you're okay." And he didn't, and I was surprised. And then, that was it. And then I think in the press conference after the match, he said, you know, I hope my opponent, you see, tennis people always say my opponent, they never use your name for some reason. So, which always annoys me. But anyway, well, certainly if you're lower down the rankings. But I hope my opponent feels better. It was one of those things. I don't know, maybe I just caught him off guard. But Yeah, and he obviously, he just retired, just had to pull out of the French Open there yesterday. He's getting surgery, I think.
That's right.
This weekend, and missing Wimbledon. So, it's still going. It's still going.
Slightly ironic that Djokovic shouldn't console you when you pull out of a match, considering he pulled out of many himself early in his career.
That's right,
and was openly called out on it by Roger Federer, among others, for being a bit of a...
He would pulling the ripcord, as we say in tennis, a lot, and he did do that a lot early in his career, and then he's just become this absolute machine. But as you say, a little bit ironic because he knows the drill when somebody retires, right?
Still around, he does, and still around. And my son and daughter who adore tennis, and a bit like your kids, and they play tennis now, and she plays tennis, particularly the young.
And 11, do they like him? Who are their favorites?
The 11 year old. She likes Coco.
Yeah.
She loves Coco.
She's great.
Coco Gauff.
Yep.
And Dash loves Kyrgios.
Okay, of course. Yeah. Good choices. Therefore,
we Djokovic is the wall. Yeah. And Djokovic is the Borg. Yes. And Djokovic is... And
not the Bjorn Borg, the cyborg.
No, the cyborg, And Djokovic... And so he comes up to me every so often and he'd look at the television for 2 seconds and he'd go...
He's going to win. I'm not going to watch that.
Yeah, or he'd look at me and he'd look down sadly at me and he'd go, I've made it now. And I go, okay. Because I'm a Federer man.
Right.
All the way.
Yeah.
And he says, admit it now.
Yeah, I'd like to stand on.
And
yeah.
I've admitted it. He's the greatest of all time. Djokovic is the greatest of all time. So for a long time I was saying... Borg was my hero, but for a long time then I completely took over Federer as the greatest of all time. And now I concede that on all metrics, Novak Djokovic is the greatest of all time. And he is, and that's it in my world. Except for grace and your determination and what you bring to the beauty of the game.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to argue it away. Nadal is still out there and still trying to do it. But I think that ship has sailed for those two guys.
Yes.
But I tell you what, Alcaraz... has absolutely everything in his locker.
He does.
And he has a smile and he has, all that as well. So he almost looked... I was watching him last night against Tsitsipas and he almost looked a little bit bored.
Yeah.
Which is kind of scary. He's just turned 21. So, you know what? I know. He probably needs... And Sinner might be that guy, but he probably needs somebody there to have a rivalry and push him, and because those guys like when you say Federer, we discount him as the greatest. We probably should still say, well, he was the first to get to that level and brought those guys up and on. And Djokovic was probably, it's a bit like the younger sibling syndrome almost, where Andy Murray was the better of the two Murrays, Serena was better than two Williams' sisters, and maybe Djokovic being that little bit behind in terms of coming through has possibly benefited from that three.
They hauled him up.
So. Because I think after the Nadal-Federer final in 2008, I believe Djokovic texted somebody, maybe it was his coach, maybe it was Roger or Rafa or somebody, but he definitely said, I have a lot to learn after that 2008 final. And he was still definitely outside that very top tier and then obviously brought it on. So, yeah.
I want to get back to just in a minute for what was going on inside your head when you were leading 4-1 against Mannarino, because the winner of that match would have played Roger Federer on centre court.
Yeah.
And you talked about, you said to me, Mario, I got tight. And you said it with that real tennis resignation that we all know.
Don't do an impression on me, though.
No, but we all know about this tennis resignation, this thing about getting tight, choking and everything. It happens to all tennis players.
Yeah.
And it's a special kind of thing. It happens sort of in golf as
well. Although the very, very top, the real champions seem to not. Like if you look at an outside court at a Grand Slam, it's happening all over the place. But like the TV tend to obviously show the main courts and it's the guys who are the front runners just getting it done every single time.
Why do they not choke?
I do not know.
This must intrigue
you. It must be because they're so much better than the player. It must be that they just don't have any doubt that it's absolutely only good, right and proper that I win this tennis match for me and everyone involved.
No matter who they're playing.
You know what I mean? Yeah, unless they're,
But what if they're playing each other?
Yeah, well, there probably is an element of tightness then. I mean, I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. What was going through your mind at 4-1? Take me inside your mind. I mean, you say you had a double break. That's two breaks of serve and you're serving to go 5-1.
Yeah.
At 5-1, the match is nearly won. And even at 4-1 with two breaks, the match is nearly won.
Yeah.
What's going through your head at 3-1, 4-1?
What was going through my head and my focus and my cue was to stay aggressive. because I have a natural tendency to be a little bit more defensive, try to hold on to a lead, probably like most people. But, you know, I had to say, tell myself, listen, you got to play on the front foot, keep looking for the forehand, keep trying to dictate with the forehand. That's what's gotten you here. And that had been my kind of theme almost for the last, for the previous year, year and a half, where I'd been making, you know, good inroads in challengers and winning challengers was, you know, I wasn't going to get there by just being solid because I was starting to play, you know, the best players in the world. So I needed to try and bring it home myself as opposed to waiting for him to lose. Mm. But obviously, a couple of points here and there, he gets more solid then. He just stopped missing. I'm then being a little bit loose. I wasn't like ridiculous, didn't feel ridiculously nervous or tight, genuinely. I didn't. I did actually when I was trying to qualify for Wimbledon and I kind of got over the line that way and it was, you know, playing, and I guess was a lesser player. But Mannarino just kind of battened down the hatches, started making a lot of balls. And when, before I was comfortable playing 5, 6, 7 shot rallies, in this instance, I talked about in the book, after 2 or 3 shots, I was kind of looking for the big one down the line and just get out of this point. And, you know, it just got away from me. And there's been books written about momentum in tennis, you know, and it was just one of those things. The momentum went to him and all of a sudden 4-1 became 4-2 like in a heartbeat, and then it was 4-3 and I felt like I was behind.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's that weird thing in tennis where you feel like you have to remind yourself, I'm actually still ahead here, but I wasn't. In terms of momentum, and that was sort of what was telling.
So, the amount of matches that are lost from the amount of sets that are lost from the one player being 5-3 up, and they lose their serve, then it's 5-5 and they lose 7-5. The amount of turnarounds you'll see like that.
Exactly.
Federer, Murray, Djokovic, any other names you can think of, what are they like in the locker room? What is their reputation? I mean, let me just, I don't know much about it at all. I love tennis and I follow it, but I don't know much about this area. It strikes me that Roger Federer can't be off in any part of life.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
He must be nice as well.
There's a scene in the book, and I don't know how many, you know, how much I should keep to myself and let somebody
know
this or how to give it. But, you know, I was in the locker room in Doha, you know, the big ATP event there before the Australian Open, was tying my shoelaces with my back to the locker room door. And I was in the last round of qualifying, so the main draw guys were just arriving. You know, I'd been there a couple of days, and I'm tying my shoelaces and I just listen and I hear this, ciao, bonjour, hello. I turn around and, you know, this golden god Roger Federer has just strutted in with a crew of his lads and was sort of smiling and looking side to side, having just greeted everyone in 3 languages.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah.
As you say, to your point, he needs to be on top of everything. So, you know, nobody was going to be left out here. I was going to say hello to everybody in their native tongue, you know. And I think I touched on it in the book that sometimes it's kind of easier for the top guys to be nice because everyone wants to be their friend anyway. Mm. You know what I mean? So he's never getting the cold shoulder in any conversation, whereas when you're a little bit down the rankings, you know, trying to befriend people and, you know, people are like, oh, who are you? Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, he was Mr., you know, king of the locker room and a man.
Popular?
A man in his element. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, Nadal strikes me as popular.
Nadal popular, yeah.
Because he's a grunt. There's something that people admire about him, the work ethic.
Yeah, no, and very, very conscious to say hello and all that.
Polite.
And, you know, if you passed him, I don't think I mentioned this scene, but I played the Queen's Club qualifying a couple of times, and I was going, there's a sort of a stairs down into the players' restaurant from this, I think it's changed now, the format back there, but I was going down the stairs and he was coming up with this, you know, the mum, the dad, the girlfriend, now wife, and, you know, 4 or 5 coaches, whatever. So they came up these stairs and took up the entirety of the stairs, you know, and I was at the top of the stairs. So I had to sort of, you know, it's like when you're going down a road, you know, to pull into the little car parking space to let your man pass. So I just sort of pull in, basically let them all come up the stairs. But he was very conscious to look at me and say, thank you.
Yes.
So, yeah, you can't really fault these guys, really. But at the same time,
Djokovic popular? I think so. Within players.
I don't know. You know what? And Murray, very popular with players.
Yeah.
Djokovic, you know, he had his moments and stuff with other players, and I don't think ever broke into that I suppose it feels like Federer and Nadal are kind of friends almost, whereas Djokovic was never invited to that sort of party. And yeah, I think so. But I suppose I just saw these guys in the locker room doing their thing. They were at work, essentially, but had these huge entourages.
You mentioned Agassi earlier on and his story about... did you have a story about Agassi?
Yes.
Oh, great. Please talk to me about Agassi. Another fascinating creature, from the clothes he wore, the denims, the long hair, to the baldness, to marrying Steffi Graf, to writing the book, to Nick Bollettieri.
Yeah, and it throws a little bit the elephant in the room with this, that obviously the great tennis book is what he wrote. And so I mentioned the book a couple of times in my book, and I have a line that... You know, obviously, I talked about hating tennis, whereas I say, you know, sometimes felt like tennis hated me. so that was sort of the difference between the two books, I suppose. But yeah, I was at college in Berkeley in Northern California, and there was an ATP event every year in San Jose, about half an hour away, every February. And Agassi used to play it. He lived in Las Vegas, so it was kind of his local tournament after the Australian Open. And we went down there as a college team when I was playing college tennis over there, you know, whatever, for the day. We got, you know, back to the players' lounge, and we were practicing on the courts and all that. It was kind of access all areas, and I was in there sitting in the players' lounge for a little while. And again, a little bit similar to Federer, I kind of had my back to the door. I should have probably faced the door, shouldn't I, at these players' lounges? Anyway, I was facing the other way, and kind of hear this gaggle of feet, and again turn around and see Andre kind of in the middle of this pit of entourage sort of folk, but actually not his entourage. So they were kind of tournament organisers, as opposed to people he had brought. And it was, you know, Andre, can I get you anything? And he was sort of like, I got a glass of water. You know, it was like he was giving the person something to do just because they'd asked. Mm. So the person was dispatched and came back with this, you know, chilled glass of water a couple of minutes later. But again, just this difference between me sitting there in the corner. Nobody knows, you know, who any of us are. And then Andre was the star around which the tournament kind of revolved. Like, the tournament needs an Andre Agassi because he's the big name, he sells the tickets. So the tournament organizers were sort of falling over themselves, and then the glass of water arrives, and he takes, you know, a half-hearted sip and puts it back down, and they kind of all leave. And I just am looking at this sort of full glass of water, you know, with Andre's fingerprints left behind. It was just kind of, yeah, it's sort of emblematic of the whole weird tennis thing, where who has the power? Is the people running the tour, or is it the very top guys? Yes. And Nadal and Federer and these guys all have, you know, get great appearance money. So there's this prize money fund for the tournament, but then there's actually the real prize money,
which you hear nothing about.
And that's Nadal and Federer would have received a lot of money over the years through those.
Can you estimate kind of figures?
I'd say you're talking a million, you know, for appearance at a 250, which is the lower level, because, you know, they have to play the Masters Series, so they wouldn't be getting them for that. But for the lower level ones,
So you're saying that sometimes when we see a major player or a top three player playing in a 250 tournament, which is a third level tournament.
Yeah, but you need to be a Grand Slam champion here to be commanding those levels.
But you're saying they're being paid, could be paid up to seven figures.
Could be in around that.
In appearance. Because then you look at the prize money for a 250 is only about 300,000.
Yeah, exactly. For the winner, it would be that. So they've banked, you know.
Yeah.
300% of that before they even play, and obviously that...
It's Tiger Woods level.
That means, you know, hey, what time do you want to practice on centre court, Roger? You know what I mean? What you know, what time is the car picking you up? You know, all those little advantages then accrete over 20 years, whereas now he's obviously gotten there by right, by ability, but then that's why these guys probably were able to keep going until they're 37, 38, because they've all these little advantages carved out. They're already better than everybody else anyway. Mm. And then they've carved this out over 20 years. So yeah, it's you know, it's a nice place to be when you're, you know, one of those top guys.
What was your top ranking again, Connor?
129.
129. And
seared into my heart.
Is it?
Yeah. Oh yeah, if that number comes up, I'm like, on my, you know, whatever, I don't know, on the time, and you know what's on the clock, I'm like, 129.
Do you know what's unfortunate about 129?
Tell me.
Well, it's obvious. It's one spot outside.
Oh yeah.
and
that's a good point, actually. Yes, in it is in it. You go on, say it out.
It's one spot outside 128.
Yes,
which is the amount of people that enter or that succeed in qualifying to the first round of a Grand Slam.
Yes,
128 to 64 to 32 to 16 and so on.
Yes.
Now, because there's wild cards and qualifiers, it doesn't always work out like that. But it's a funny number.
But I never actually thought of that. Maybe I have and forgotten, but yes, it's exactly right.
Well, now 129 is even seared in your brain even more because of my.
But I have a friend who got to 100, so yeah. And would always slag him like, you were never really top 100.
Jeez, who was that?
Yeah, a guy called Jeff Salzenstein, an American guy. So he's like top 100 means the top 100 players, and I was 100, yeah. So I got in.
What did the top 100? And you don't have to. You can only guess this. What did the top 120? What did the number 129 approximately player in the world would have earned last year?
Oh God! Well, it's improved since I stopped a little bit because the Grand Slam qualifying. Prize money's improved a lot, so they put a lot of extra prize money into that, in fairness, and it's a bit of an arms race, the Grand Slams, now, because everyone wants to be known as the best one and the biggest one. So you know, once the Australian Open increases theirs, they, you know, the rest of them have to kind of keep up. So oh God, I could be wrong, Mario. I don't know. The top 129 probably made 140, 150 last year, maybe. But again, that's before all their expenses.
That's no good.
You know, maybe 200, but again,
it's not much good though.
Yeah, well, they're spending 100 grand minimum, probably on the coach and the whole lot, depending how they're doing it and who their federation is and stuff. But yeah, the problem is though, like, even if you started paying the guys outside the top 100 more money, they're still outside the top 100, and they're still outside the fun of playing Grand Slams and being on the main tour. So let's say you're 150 in the world, and let's say you are making, you know, decent money, 200 grand that you can actually take home, or 100 grand that you can take home. You're still playing in front of five people in God knows where, and you still feel a little bit on the outside. Yeah. So,
but this is the fascinating part for me, having watched it for years and having played tennis at club level for years and having seen really good players come into that club to play what they call ATP Futures events. So when you see an ATP Future event, let's say in Carrick Mines in Dublin, and you might see a player who's currently ranked 400 in the world, but you look at his history and he did have a top ranking of 270.
Yeah.
He dropped down to 670 because of injury, and now he's fighting his way up again. And you look at this player and you just go, wow, what a player.
Yeah.
And some of them are more brilliant than others, and some of them have a real talent. And you're going, then you see that player finish his match in Carrick Mines in Dublin, and then you see him half an hour later
going for the bowl of soup on his own in the corner.
And he's sitting on the ground, right, on the floor, right, in his sweaty shorts, scrolling through his phone with people stepping over him on the way to the jacks. For all the extent, he looks like a homeless person, right? And yet, if you Google him, you say he's number three in Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
That means he's the third best tennis player in a world sport, in a huge country of 40 or 50 million people.
Exactly.
If he was an accountant who was the third biggest accountant, he would be a multi-millionaire, right? With employing thousands of people. And this guy's sitting on the ground. It's always struck me as amazing that you were, at one stage, the officially 129th tennis player in the world, in a world in which every country plays tennis.
Yeah.
And they all see it on TV and they all want to be. It's like being a singer.
Mm.
And so it's fascinating that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Like, I think when I was at 129, I think I might have been two in Britain behind Murray. I don't know if anyone in Britain had a top 100 ranking outside Andy at the time. Okay. So, you know, if you think about the second best cricketer, rugby player, soccer player, darts player, snooker player in Britain and Ireland, you know, they're household names and all that. So yeah, that is the problem with tennis. And again, talk about it in the book, it's that the people I feel sorry for are the guys who are 2, 3, 4, 5 in a country like Canada or Australia even. And maybe Australia have a few guys in the top 100, but a lot of these countries are, you know, you're 3, 4, 5 in your country, and you are, you know, you're on the ground in a tennis club in Ireland, you know, trying to book a flight home. And
you have a chapter 9 called The Math. What's The Math about?
Yeah, so that's about the ATP ranking system, point system. Because it's all woven into my story. So I had just won a challenger. I was getting to a career high. Then I get injured. I'm out for a few months. All of a sudden, because your ranking points that you win only last for 12
weeks.
Months,
yeah.
for 52 weeks. So you're constantly kind of up against the clock on that. So as soon as you wake up the next morning having won a tournament, you know, you're a little bit closer to those points dropping off. So, yeah, it talks about that, explains that. To people who you know don't know how the tour works, so we've pitched it where tennis fans will definitely love this book, I think, and people who don't follow tennis are it's explained to them.
Just back to this point that the best accountant in the world isn't always the best paid accountant in the world. In fact, the best accountant in the world could be living in his mum's house in the box room. Yeah. And he just hasn't the person skills to go into the local KPMG and get a good job. The best singer in the world could be living in their folk's house singing into a brush.
Yeah.
The best looking person in the world is subjective. It's whoever you think is how do we regard as beautiful?
Yeah.
But the best tennis player in the world is the best tennis player on the world. There's no guy called Joshua from New Zealand or from China who's actually better than this tennis player. They are the best.
Yeah.
So that is the purity of the sport.
Yeah.
When you see Djokovic play Sinner or Alcaraz, you are looking at the two best tennis players on the planet. It's not a subjective thing.
Yes.
It's sport. Correct. And it's even more pure than soccer, because soccer, all sorts of bums get breaks.
Yeah, there's no money ball in tennis, right? It's results and results only. There's no stats or opinions or anything. So, if somebody asked me who's up and coming, who's the next big thing at 17, 18, you know what you do? You go and look at their results. You don't watch them on TV. And I tell you what, it never lets you down. So like Holger Rune now, who's top 10 in the world, I was looking at his results at 16, 17, and he's going to be top 10. Like, guarantee it. Just based on his results of where he was tracking, you don't need to go and look at what his forehand looks like.
Mm. Having said that, when you see the list of Wimbledon junior winners, it doesn't always come through.
Yes, but I think a lot of that is because by 17 or 18, I think if, Wimbledon junior championships for under 18s, a lot of 17, 18-year-olds who are going to be great have already gone past juniors. Like, Nadal made third round of Wimbledon seniors at 17. Mm. So, I think that's why I think it's not necessarily always a match.
Croatia has a population of 5.2 million people.
Yeah.
I don't know any Croatian tennis players, but I know they have loads of good tennis players.
Goran.
And Goran Ivanišević.
Yeah.
And they have loads of female and male tennis players. And their footballers are obviously fantastic. So I'm going to ask you that question again. Why isn't it that in a country that is obsessed with sport, and we are, and a country that is unquestionably talented at sport, we're sending 10 boxers. Boxing is not unlike tennis. We're sending boxers to the Olympics, 10 boxers to the Olympics in Paris this year.
Yeah.
Superb rugby players, as we know, and rugby is a very patterned game as well. It's a lot of intelligence needed in rugby, and there's an awful lot of intelligence needed in chess, or in tennis. I said chess. And chess. It's exactly similar. Why do you think it is? I would say one thing. It's very snobby in this country to play tennis.
A lot of tennis courts in Croatia. I've played futures there, and every local village that I ever ended up in, that's where I played all my tournaments in Croatia, in local villages. And there was courts everywhere. There was clay courts everywhere, and it seemed like it was sort of a normal thing to do. You see a village in Ireland and it's a GA pitch in Croatia. Okay. It was like tennis courts everywhere. Yes. They love tennis. And they love, and I know some people say, oh, well, we have our Gaelic football and our hurling, but they have their handballs and stuff that we don't do. So they dilute their talent pool with other sports and basketball. They're unbelievable at basketball.
Yeah, they
send people to the NBA. I'm only sort of shooting from the hip here a bit, but they are kind of athletic people. They seem to produce tall, athletic people as well. They're Croatians, which obviously suits tennis. I think it's just part of their culture. And again, guys like Marin Cilic have won US Opens from Croatia.
But why not Ireland, Connor?
We don't have an international tournament structure of any sort in Ireland, so there might be one futures event here this year. you know, Croatia, I think, has probably two tour events, some main tour events. You know, they've got a number of challenger events, futures events, junior tour events. So they've got all that locked
in. You're saying there's not enough top-class tennis happening in this country where some wild cards and players from Ireland can jump in and play and compete against?
Yeah, I know. It's these things are expensive to put on, and I haven't looked at the numbers on it or anything, but like, we should really have an ATP or a WTA event here. Every other country in Western Europe seems to have one. I think it would be an amazing opportunity to put, obviously, our players, wild cards, all that.
Did I bore you with the statistic the last time we talked? That you said there aren't enough tennis courts in Ireland, and I agree with that.
Mm.
But it's a funny one, because there are an awful lot of tennis clubs in Ireland.
Yeah, and a lot of members, yeah.
And tennis clubs are different to tennis courts.
Yeah.
Because I may have told you this the last time. Ireland has the most tennis clubs per capita in the world. And it's based on our Victorian heritage as being the second city of the empire in London. So London was the capital of the empire, and they go, let's go on holiday to Dublin, and we'll go to the summer house in Cotton House and play tennis.
And that's why we had Wimbledon champions in the 19th century.
And that's why a massive tournament was played until very recently in Fitzwilliam.
Yeah, the Irish Open was a huge tennis for the 60s and into the 70s, and we lost that. And I think, you know, that had a massive impact in terms of visibility in the country for tennis, inspiration, opportunity, all that. So that would be, I think, really important. And we can go into the whole, you know, performance structures and all that stuff. But I think if we could have a marquee event, I think a lot of good would come from that.
Tell us the little story about you and beating Federer again. I want to hear that one.
So I was in the tournament called the Winter Cup, which is a four-person under 14 event that all the top countries, or sorry, all the countries send their teams, and we had played Switzerland in a match. I had lost to their number one, a Japanese guy, or chap of Japanese heritage called Jun Kato, really talented. I think I was a year young, beat me pretty handy. We lost to Switzerland, and then we set up a kind of a reverse match. So I played the other Swiss lad, and he had, kind of an undercut, black hair, all Nike clothes, nice one-handed backhand Mario, and but was pretty loose, like was making unforced errors and all the rest, and making some great shots, but like, you know, didn't seem hugely intense about it all. But at the same time, you know, we had a match, a best of three set match, and I won. And a couple of years later, I found the notes from the match in my room. Because our coach, the time guy called Jim Watt from Belfast, who brought us, you know, he'd write down number of unforced errors you made and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And at the top of the page, it had Sean Ireland, R. Federer, you know, 7-5, 6-2. And I was like, oh, I think that guy like won Junior Wimbledon this year. And ended up seeing him at Junior Wimbledon actually later that summer. And or he'd just won Orange Bowl, I think it was. And ended up, having played one of the greats. And I think at around that time when I played him, I guess we were 12, 13, he then moved to the Swiss Tennis Federation, and basically, you know, left home, boarded at the Swiss Tennis Federation then for about 3 or 4 years before going full time. Whereas I, you know, went back to Ireland, was training in Limerick, sort of, you know, practicing with my mum, you know, and then went to boarding school in England, college in the States. I had this really different kind of path and a much safer path. Now, obviously, you know, Roger had incredible talent and had a wildly more successful career than I did. But at the same time, those choices you make at 14, 15, 16, 17,
they're the ones.
Do obviously impact massively on your trajectory. And, you know, I talk about that in the book quite a bit as well.
The other thing is, it's inescapable. I think it is, unless you can kind of help me out with it. But there's a class element to this as well. I mean, I don't even know about Roger Federer, but you know that his parents are either well off, very well off, well off.
His dad was like a pharmaceutical executive. His mum's South African, actually. Mm. But yeah, no, very comfortable.
Comfortably, to be able to.
Basel,
They're not taking a mad gamble by investing. They have the money to invest some money.
Yeah,
in his career, probably enough to get him to a certain point.
Yes, I don't know Novak. You know, I think it was probably a little bit more of a struggle. But again, went to Germany to an academy over there at 14. Rafa had his uncle training him in Mallorca growing up, Andy Murray had his mum, who was a Scottish national coach. She was
embedded within
very
the tennis.
Underrated, yeah. Sort of as an impact and a coach, I think, and an influence. And it's hard to do it without the support.
Yeah. Connor, did you ever? I don't know if I asked you this question the last time. Did you ever? For those of you who play sport out there, are at any level. And one of the things you'd always hope to do is that if you're playing a match of any kind, that at least you could play your very, very best. And you come out going, I can't believe, I think that's the best I ever played. Did you ever or often play the best you've ever played in a match that meant things?
Yeah, I mean, people talk about that, you know, you're in the zone and that. I was told something once that kind of always felt kind of rang true, at least for me, was that for every 10 matches you play, this is from a fellow pro, for every 10 matches you play, one will be really bad or bad, one will be really, really good, and then the other 8 are kind of your level, and that's sort of how you build a career almost. So it also allows you to sort of throw out the bad ones every now and then, because it's sort of just the way it happens. You can't be absolutely very solid. And even within a tournament, a lot of guys will play a bad match and scrape through, like an Alcaraz even, or somebody, whoever wins this at the French Open, you might look back and go, he had one kind of ugly, scrappy match where he didn't play great, but he still got through it. In terms of, did I zone? Yeah, I did. Off the top of my head, I can't think of... Actually, my first Challenger final was a strange one, because I had played a match the night before that had gotten rained off, and it was a... like 6-4 in the third, an absolute battle, 3 hours, and woke up the next morning, had to finish the match, but it was also the scheduled day of the final, and there was another tournament. The Challenger was on the same venue for the 2 weeks, so I finished this match like 35 degree humidity in Delhi in India, won the 3-setter, and then they were like, obviously your final, my first ever Challenger final, was in like an hour and a half's time or 2 hours time, and it's like unbelievably hot. I've just, you know, been, obviously got to the final, I'm pretty tired, ended up going back to my room, was like, will I even go back out, just lie in my bed, and then sort of look at the clock, and it's like, right, I gotta go back to the courts now. So after about 45 minutes, and I kind of just hopped out of bed and went down there with no real expectation, was so loose, and ended up kind of, I suppose, knowing that I couldn't not win in straight sets, and probably played a little bit more aggressively, and I felt like I served out of my tree. I did not have a particularly good serve, certainly at that level. Served great, loads of cheap points on my serve. I was like, this is easy, I should play like this all the time, play a lot more aggressive, and ended up winning that match. And that was kind of a, I'm really glad I played kind of out of my head there, because I did not have the energy for a proper battle, which was a lot of my tennis was sort of, you know, made a lot of balls, ran and grounded out, and so it was nice to feel like, you know, Nick Kyrgios or somebody for an hour and a half and just be great. Slapping it around.
I like that story. Tell everybody, wants to hear this, the one story though, the story of the backhand you faced from one of the greatest backhand opponents of all time. You played a tennis player at Mount Pleasant Tennis Club called Mario Rosenstock. It was in an exhibition match, and we were knocking up. I think you described that you've never faced a backhand as
more awkward.
And tell us about this backhand and what it did to you. True story, folks.
I thought with the take back, I thought it was going one way, and then it went the other, and I think I got a little bit confused. But it was a really fun day at Mount Pleasant. Yeah, we were doing a charity gig a few years ago, Mario, and as I'm sure you remember well, and I had just played, I think, an exhibition match with somebody, a guy called Barry King, and then you came on and we were hitting a few balls, and you hit this beautiful little backhand up the line, turned me one way and then the other. I went out to hit a sort of a slid over, and rolled over on my ankle and went down like a sack of potatoes.
And I thought he was taking the piss.
As did the whole balcony in Mount Pleasant. Oh, this is a Mario prank. I've done had a chat before.
And you were injured.
And I rolled my ankle. My ankle was the size of a football.
Jesus
and
Christ,
and nobody went over to me, because, again, they thought it was funny. Yeah, or they thought I was joking. And I love that you keep bringing it up all these years later, and
it is a killer slice though, Connor, in fairness.
It is. Little inside out. It was just curling away from me, and, you know, the slider.
The slider. I love that shot. It's my favourite shot. And piece of advice for me. I wouldn't. You know, I just need some advice. You said playing good there. And you said 8 out of 10 matches people play at their level, and one is good, really good, and one is really bad. Mm. I play really, really below par all the time in matches.
Oh, okay.
And I was wondering if there's anything you could tell me to do to that that could help. I get nervous, I get tight, and I play fearful, and I'm terrified to win and lose.
So what I would always try and do was in practice was try and move my feet almost like it was a joke. Like I would move my feet so much in practice that it almost looked like I was taking the mick. So, because in a match situation with that little bit of nerves, if you train at that level of unbelievable intensity with your footwork in a match, it's going to come down a little bit, but at least it's coming down from a really, really high level to maybe a decent level or a high level. And the same with my racket head speed. I would always try and exaggerate my racket speed in practice, because in a match with tightness and nerves, it's naturally going to come down. And also then with my depth, so trying to hit the ball as close as they could to the baseline in practice, because naturally all that is going to come down. So I would have baked that in. I would always try and practice at this certain pitch, because I knew it would always come off in a match. And that didn't, obviously took a long time for me to figure that out, but that was something I really focused on for my last couple of years. Now that is one way of looking at it. The other is just, you know, go speak to somebody and have a few tips and mental cues.
I need to speak to somebody, because it's one of the most peculiar experiences I've ever had in my life. I love.
And is it one particular? Like, is it a serve that goes? Is it a shot selection? What kind of happens? I suppose in practice, or is it something different?
So my weaker shot is the forehand, and instead of hitting the forehand, I start poking it.
Okay.
So I stop coming over the ball. I stop hitting the top forehand topspin, and I start squash shotting it.
Right.
Just to tap it back into play. I go more and more into my shell.
Yeah.
And I hit the ball later and later and later almost it's hitting the ground. It's like I don't want to hit the ball. In other words, I'm basically saying to my opponent, please, I want you to make a mistake. I don't want to play the next shot.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really horrible. Yeah. And I tighten up, and that's why I asked you a question about
it. I think just really focusing on coming over the ball with an extra bit of racket speed in practice, almost like it's a joke, you know what I mean?
What about in a match? I mean, we can edit all this, but if this part is boring to listen to, because this is just me asking you stuff. But what about in a match? I mean, should I try and play at the beginning, play the shots that I want to play, and hope that I play myself into a bit of form? Because I'm afraid that if I play tight at the beginning, I'll just get tighter and tighter.
You almost
should I try and just play?
Yeah, I think so. I think you got to try and go big with your margins. So you play aggressive at the start, but bring your margins way in. So like, really fast shots, but through maybe the middle of the court for the first game or two, or only cross court. Like never go down the line for the first game or two, just to get you into that rhythm. Obviously in the warm up, being a little bit extra with the feet and the racket speed as well, and then that brings you into the first couple of games of the match. Just go through the middle of the court, lots of footwork, lots of racket speed, and that will build you into hopefully a bit of confidence.
Okay. I know you had an interview planned with Brendan O'Connor, so you were going to do that this Sunday, were you?
Well, Brendan's on holidays, so I think it will be somebody who will be standing in for him.
Okay. I wonder who that would be, actually.
I think it might be Áine Kerr.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Connor, the book is called The Racket, on tour with tennis's golden generation and the other 99%. Ha ha ha. Connor Nyland. Elegant and powerful, it's kitchen confidential for tennis, says Ed Caesar. Connor, it's been great meeting you again and seeing you, and you're such a gent. Lovely talking to you, and I wish you the best of luck with this book.
Thanks so much, Mario. Always a pleasure. Cheers.
And that's it. And already The Racket by Connor Nyland is doing brilliantly in the world of sports books. Going absolutely fantastic. And I'm delighted for Connor. He's genuinely a sweet and understated kind of guy with a very dry sense of humour. And I really enjoyed our chat together. Okay, same time, same place next week. See you then.